Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do they really know? Every week, me, Jason Carty,
and me, Stephen Cockcroft, the Beatle Brains of Ireland, go here, there and everywhere, taking a forensic deep dive into the story of the greatest band of all time, the Beatles.
Come with us every week on a magical mystery tour as we talk albums, singles, solo careers, books, films, and so much more.
Become a member of Nothing Is Real on Acast Plus today for ad-free content, bonus episodes, and so much more, because happiness is a warm podcast.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Nothing Is Real, a Beatles podcast, is powered by Acast. Welcome to Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. My name's Jason Carty.
My name's Stephen Cockcroft.
And we're live on tape from Dublin and Belfast. If you were a Beatles fan at the end of 1970, there was four potential solo albums that you could have gotten in your Christmas stocking that year, which might have somewhat softened the blow of the group's demise announced earlier in 1970. As we talk today, it's 50 years since all these albums came out, and we're going to look at some of them across this season of Nothing Is Real. And today we're going to talk about John Lennon's Plastic Ono Band, the first proper, in inverted commas, album from John Lennon. Do you like Plastic Ono Band, Stephen?
I do like Plastic Ono Band. I like it. I don't love it. Yeah. I think that's maybe a... I know people regard this as one of the best solo albums. I think it's a good album. I enjoy it. It's not an album that I really sit down and listen to all the way through. I would cherry pick some songs from it, but it's not an easy listen.
No, it's not an easy listen. And I think the creators of it would kind of say as well, it's not an easy listen. But it's interesting that even after 50 years, the unease that you can hear from the album is still palpable, and that's a credit to its makers, really.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I think as a sort of snapshot of where Lennon was at the time, where his head was at, man, you know, I think it's a very powerful statement. But I would query whether you would listen to it for pleasure.
Yeah, and this notion that they all had solo albums out by the end of 1970, you know, obviously you and me are way too young to have realized what that was like, but. You know, I'm wondering which of them, you know, John, Paul, George, Ringo, which one of them delivered an album that was true to type, you know? And were people kind of expecting John to do this kind of thing? Because, you know, you kind of look at his whole year, there's a lot going on.
There is. I mean, you know, what we've had to date are the sort of three experimental albums, which he did with Yoko. You've got this the live piece in Toronto. He's had singles with Give Peace a Chance and Cold Turkey. I suppose Cold Turkey is maybe the closest in feel to what's happening on Plastic Ono Band. Then you have Instant Karma at the beginning of the year, a lot more commercial. It's a sort of bona fide pop hit, yeah. I suppose. But I'm not sure that any of those really give much of a hint as to what's coming.
Yeah, I always sort of felt that, you know, Cold Turkey is to Plastic Ono Band as Instant Karma is to Imagine. You know, it's kind of like one kind of sharp, brutal thing followed by one kind of more poppy thing. Even though, you know, you'd sometimes lose looking back that there's a year between Cold Turkey and Plastic Ono Band.
I think that's it. You tend to think of these things just tumbling into each other. Yeah. And I suppose in a way, there's so much happening in 69 and 70 across all four of them, and the sort of the split and the court case and the infighting. And the meanwhile, as you say, they're all producing their own solo output.
Yeah. So let's start by rewinding back to January 1970, because the seeds are all there. And we've done an episode back in season one about January 1970. It's one of these kind of very curious moments in time where the Beatles are falling apart. But right at the start of the month, Paul, George and Ringo go into Abbey Road and they record the last brand new Beatles song, which is I, Me, Mine, because it's needed for the Let It Be / Get Back soundtrack. And they tinker with the Let It Be single. But they are there without John, because right at the start of the year, John is in Denmark.
Denmark, yeah.
And what's he doing in Denmark?
He's Yoko's ex-husband, Tony Cox, is in Denmark. And they're visiting him. And one of the sort of background features to the sort of late 60s, early 70s is this estrangement between Yoko and her former husband and their daughter, Kyoko. And that will sort of spill over into the early 70s, where John and Yoko are trying to, in some cases, actually locate the husband. You know, he keeps disappearing with the daughter. But they are ostensibly reaching out to her husband to try and, I suppose, establish a relationship with Yoko's daughter.
And it's in Denmark that they shave off all their hair.
Yeah, I mean this is
symbolic,
a very
I guess.
Lennon they have been extremely high profile in 69. They're running their peace campaign. One of the things that is very striking at that time is they sort of look identical. They both have very long hair. They're dressing in white. This becomes a sort of a trademark.
Yep.
And then suddenly at the start of 1970, they just virtually shave their head. I mean, it's a very, very short cropped haircut. They donate the hair to an organization in London, you know, for charity. They're standing on the roof of Apple, handing hair over in a bag. I think they auctioned it. I'm not sure. Perhaps someone out there has a bag of hair.
It's a very 1969 kind of piece vibe. It's interesting how they're kind of, you know, you see the start of 1970, those things start to drift away.
Yes. I mean, one of the, if you remember back to the bed-in, they have hair piece and this idea of grow your hair for peace.
Yeah.
And then suddenly they're appearing, you know, very, very short haircut. You can see it in the Instant Karma video.
Yeah.
From Top of the Pops. The peace campaign is still going on at this stage. They declare 1970 as being year one for peace. But it's not, Instant Karma aside, it's not perhaps a very good start to the year for them. They had this lithograph exhibition that Lennon has. It's raided by the police on the grounds of obscenity. So you have that sort of hanging over them for the start of the year. He's involved in trying to set up something called the Peace Festival in Toronto, which is really capitalizing on the 1969 live Peace in Toronto album. That grinds into a sort of runs into the sand as a very sort of ignominious failure. It sort of starts to fall apart. There's Lennon starts falling out with the organizers. I think one of the things they suggested was they'd invented a flying car that ran on psychic energy, and they would quite like John and Yoko to arrive. It doesn't need any fuel, man. So it all, you know, there's it's all part of that, I suppose, shift from the late 60s love and peace and into that sort of more cynical 1970s paranoia.
Yeah.
Think that, you know, the Canadian police are monitoring Lennon at this stage. It subsequently transpires, you know, but whereas he'd always sort of felt Canada was a bit of a refuge for him and very welcoming. So it's interesting to think, is this cutting of the hair, some kind of subconscious symbolism as well.
Well, they do. I mean, the one good thing about that Copenhagen trip is, even though Lennon isn't around to meet up with the other three, and maybe that might have meant something different, he comes back with the notion of karma in his pocket, and he develops this song, Instant Karma. And the story of Instant Karma is written in a day, recorded in a day, released as quickly as possible. And that happens right at the end of January. So we still have this great song. And he's around, and you know, they're spending the start of the year, once they're back from Denmark, they're based in London for those initial months of 1970.
That's right, that's right. And Instant Karma is a phrase apparently Tony Cox's wife used.
There you go.
Around the dinner table, and Lennon just filed it away.
As you do. They're in London, you know, they're on Top of the Pops. They make that famous appearance on Top of the Pops where they're doing Instant Karma. But at the same time, in the background, the Beatle business is dragging out. I guess at some point it's realized that, you know, Let It Be has to happen. Paul is doing his secret solo album. Spector only gets involved quite late, around about March time, on Let It Be, but that's with the say-so of the other three, i.e. John, George and Ringo. So there's still Beatle business going on in the background. And then at the end of March, Yoko announces she's pregnant. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. That's right.
So it's a very sort of busy, hectic time for them. So what happens to John next? He gets a book, doesn't he?
He gets a book. So he gets this book from Arthur Janov about primal scream therapy. And this, you know, I suppose the thing is, Lennon never does anything by half measures. So if it's the Maharishi, or it's a peace campaign, or you know, whatever it is he's doing, he throws himself into this absolutely wholeheartedly. This book sort of grabs his attention, and he just picks it up and runs with it. So the next thing we have, Arthur Janov, who's written this book, arrives in London on the 31st of March, sets up a temporary office in London, and suddenly John and Yoko are involved in this primal scream therapy.
And primal scream therapy, or primal therapy, or whatever you want to call it, is, you know, it's a new thing. It's really only in the previous, I think in the previous year, that Janov has kind of given it a name, and he's only been working on it for about 2 or 3 years. And it's sort of it's very experimental. It's an experimental psychotherapy model.
It is. And I mean, I suppose sitting here in 2020, looking back, you can think, well, this is just another West Coast American faddish.
Yes, we can think that.
You know, psychological mumbo jumbo, let's say. But you know, Tears for Fears, you know, they picked that up and ran with it as well.
And also the band Primal Scream, who
there you go.
Yeah, I'm not a fan.
You're not a fan.
Not a fan.
Okay. So I mean, I'm not I don't think either of us are probably qualified to go into the you know, the detail of what primal scream therapy, much less criticize it. But
oh, really?
but let's do that anyway.
Yeah.
So the idea seems to be, you can relate all of your problems, all of your adult psychoses, back to traumatic events that happened in your childhood, and if you recreate the sort of experience of relived experience of your own birth, you can sort of wipe the slate clean and start again. So it's a sophisticated take on the it's all your parents' fault.
It is a version of it's all your parents' fault. And I think cometh the hour, if you think about what was happening at the times, it seems like almost a perfect type of psychotherapy for the times, because, you know, you're kind of piggybacking on a group of people who, you know, John in particular, you know, was using LSD in, you know, a few years previously. There's an awful lot of that that's related to childhood and regressing and looking backwards. And it feels that, you know, the only reason we're talking about primal therapy this year, currently 50 years later, is because of these rock star associations.
Yeah.
Certainly there does not appear to be any strong scientific consensus that it is an amazing, incredible breakthrough form of psychotherapy. If you kind of look at the references for it, I mean, he went on to make a decent career out of it, but it's very much based on, you know, reflecting back the experiential discussions of the patient.
It's interesting to sort of speculate whether, if Lennon hadn't done this and hadn't made this album,
yeah,
would we still be talking about it?
No, I don't think we would, because it's not, it's not a, it doesn't have a particular stakehold in hospital psychotherapy or hospital psychological medicine, as far as I can make out.
I've never been tempted to.
Well, it's you know, it's you laugh about it being trendy at the time, but it does work, because it's basically telling the individual that they're special. And this notion that the 60s gave us, which still trickles through today, that you can be the curated self, or that you yourself are particularly fascinating, then this is a type of therapy that serves to feed that kind of ego message. Maybe am I being unfair?
No, I think that's fair. And you can see, you know, Lennon himself has said, you know, sometimes I think I'm the worst person in the world. Sometimes I think I'm a genius. You can see how that would absolutely just tick that box for him. Plus, you have all those well-trodden stories about his relationship with his mother, with his aunt, with his father, you know, all of that going on. So he's sort of the ideal candidate for this.
I mean, he has a known story about his upbringing, which is a traumatic upbringing. I'm not making light of that at all. But I have a quote here from Janov, which he says, you know, we should not lose track of the overarching truth. Feelings are their own validation. We can quote and cite scientific studies all day long, you know, but the ultimate truth lies in the experience of human beings, and their feelings explain so much that the statistical evidence is irrelevant.
Alternative facts.
It's a type of alternative facts, you know. And, you know, the thing about primal therapy, it you know, when I was reading about it, is that, you know, this term that Stephen Colbert termed, which is truthiness, you know, there's a truthiness to it. You kind of think, yeah, I guess if I did sort out my childhood problems, I'd feel better. I mean, that kind of seems like a reasonable thing to do. But whether shouting and screaming about them is the best way, I don't know. There are other kind of models. I'm also thinking of Mike Oldfield went through a thing, I think, called exegenesis, which was a very similar rebirthing process that changed his music in the late 70s.
Perhaps we should, for research, we should do this and then start another podcast.
Yes, exactly, which would be very screamy. But I'll tell you, do you know who else did primal scream therapy? James Earl Jones. And do you know what he says it cured?
What did it cure?
It cured his hemorrhoids.
Excellent.
So that's so it's not all bad, you know. So
I'm going to say I'll keep that in my back pocket.
Well, that's a bit close. But you have so Lennon in March gets this primal therapy book, as you say, a bit like the Maharishi, is immediately drawn into it. They get some sessions with the man himself in London and in Tittenhurst, but he tries to say, listen, if you want to go the full kit and caboodle, off you come to LA.
Yes. So, I mean, Janov actually talks about the fact that they were building the studio Ascot Sounds at Tittenhurst, and this provided an ideal kind of soundproof venue for this. And Lennon was actually in the middle of his therapy whenever Paul phones him the night before the McCartney album goes out for review.
That set off a few screams, I'd say.
You know, yeah, calm down, but I'm putting out this album. Here is the interview, and I'm leaving the band. So all this is happening. But yes, then they fly out on the 23rd of April to LA.
And do we know specifically that Paul told them the whole details of the press release? Or do you just say, you just might notice something in the papers tomorrow? See you, Chuck.
I think the story that I hear is that sounded more like Cilla Black. The story that I've read is that he actually tells him, you know, I'm leaving the band, I'm putting the album out, and this is and sort of I'm putting out this press release.
Okay, so is
now, I mean, whether that's strictly accurate, because you know, you and I have talked about this before, that if you read that press release, He doesn't actually say in that interview that goes out, I am leaving the band.
No, it's a bit reversible.
I mean, he has made previous statements that sort of went unnoticed. about quitting the band, or the Beatles won't record again. And but this is the press release that produces the Paul quits Beatles headline.
And that's the line that a lot of people use. That's the date in the sand, or the line in the sand that people use. So then just after that, April 23rd, John and Yoko fly off to LA for some proper B&B at Phil Spector's.
This is very funny. This is very funny. They go and they stay at Phil Spector's house, and Yoko was given an interview, and she said it was cold, it was damp, it was like a, and this is the quote, a crummy castle, terrible food, and best of all, after they've left, he sends them a bill for breakfast.
Amazing.
What a guy.
What a guy. And, you know, this leads into May 1970. So in the real world, the Phil Spector Let It Be is coming out, you know, Long and Winding Road is eventually, you know, number one that summer in the US. So the Beatles are still, although it's been announced that they are essentially over, they're still releasing new material and having material in the charts. And, you know, if you go back and look at those weeks between March to June, it's insanely busy with the overlapping stuff between the four of them. And John is kind of entering this therapy cycle in the middle of all of it. And so do they spend the whole summer in primal therapy, or how long are they there doing that?
Well, they have problems with visas.
Yeah.
So again, this becomes a feature of his stay in America, ultimately sort of much later in the decade. But they have difficulties with visas. They're trying to get extensions for medical grounds. Ultimately, it runs all the way up to the middle of September. But during this period, they're undertaking this primal therapy. The visas start to expire. They're under threat of sort of expulsion from the country. At one point, he tries to persuade Janov to shift the therapy to Mexico. You know, just relocate to Mexico to suit me. There's a sort of a falling out with Janov, because Janov says, "Well, one of the key things here is to videotape this, or to film the sessions." And this is the point at which Lennon suddenly thinks that's not happening.
Yeah.
You know, I'm John Lennon. You are not filming me rolling around the floor crying like a baby. I'm not having that. You know, obviously now if this, he would have this up on his Instagram account, and it would all be there. But so there seems to be a sort of an ebb and flow to what's happening. But also during this period, he starts to record demos.
Yes. And he does. So which songs start to percolate through while he's in the States?
Well, he records several songs. I mean, My Mommy's Dead is one of them. God is there's an embryonic version of that floating around. And the demo dating from the 26th of July seems to be the first occasion in which he uses the line, "I don't believe in Beatles."
Yeah.
So
So all of this is starting to coalesce around the same time that he's going through all this psychotherapy. And Jan Wenner from Rolling Stone is also appearing as well, and he'll go on to play a role later in the year.
Yes, I mean, I think John and Yoko's relationship with Jan Wenner is probably worth an episode in itself at some point. Rolling Stone is, you know, very, very pro-John. Jan Wenner, you get the sense there's a little bit of, maybe more than a little bit of hero worship there. In May, they have flown to San Francisco and they visited Rolling Stone's offices. In August, Rolling Stone is reporting that John has 20 new songs ready to go. He's going to go into the studio in the next couple of months. There's a new album on the way. So Rolling Stone, very supportive. And then, as you say, later in the year, we get this very famous Lennon Remembers interview, which ultimately, when Wenner decides to put that out as a book, that sort of
splits them up again.
Yeah, because John does not want this out as a book. I think by that time the book is coming out, he probably realizes the interview 1970 was a particular time, a particular mindset, and it's not reflective necessarily of how he feels about things now or then.
Okay. And then at the end of July, sadly, Yoko miscarries.
Yeah.
And this, I think, is her second miscarriage.
It's her third, I think, miscarriage, yeah.
Which is obviously another traumatic and difficult time for them. And Cynthia Lennon remarries.
She remarries at this time, almost at the same time, end of July.
I wonder how much of that was on John's radar at the time. I suppose he would have had to have known it was happening.
Yeah.
We don't know. But they spend the summer in the States. And then, as you say, it's essentially a visa issue that sends them back in mid-September.
Yes, yes.
And Janov has said that Lennon shouldn't have quit or he shouldn't have left.
This is my theory, that, or at least a theory that I subscribe to, is that, you know, the idea about primal scream therapy, as I understand it, is it kind of breaks you down and then you begin the second stage of kind of building back up your self-esteem, or this idea that you mentioned earlier, the curated self.
Yeah.
And what Janov says later is, we had opened him up and we didn't have time to put him back together again.
Yeah.
So it seems to me, I mean, one of the, I realize I'm going to alienate a huge amount of the listeners out there, but one of the things that always strikes me is how steep the decline is in Lennon's output after 1971. So you get Plastic Ono Band, you get Imagine, then you get Sometime in New York City, which I don't think is anyone's favorite album. You get Mind Games, which is, again, I don't think a great piece of work. You get Walls and Bridges, you get Rock and Roll. So it really does, I'm not going to say it falls off a cliff, but, you know, you've got a great 14-track best of album of his career and not much else.
So you're saying
I can hear people switching off.
What's the sound of a podcast being turned off? You're saying it's diminishing returns, but is that, you think that's related to him not the door on his therapy?
Yeah, I think part of, I think if you look back at a lot of what he's, you know, like any artist, I suppose, he's using his own personal issues, his emotional response to things to produce this kind of great art. And one of Lennon's great strengths is the ability to take something very personal, a very personal experience, and sort of tease that out into something universal that you or I or some other listener can think, yes, I can empathize with that, or that triggers something. So Strawberry Fields, for example, you know, there's something there, you know, childhood experiences, very personal to him. It's a very odd song. It's a very odd lyric. But there's something in there that everyone can sort of relate to, or it rings a bell or strikes a chord with people. But it seems to me that after you get past 1970, he sort of loses that facility, that maybe he's worked through some things. He's got, you know, they talk about it's the grit in the oyster that produces the pearl. He's kind of got rid of those things, but he hasn't really regained control of himself. He hasn't gone through that second stage.
But is it just a question, though, and this is the sound of the other half of the listeners turning off, which is that, you know, it's, he kind of makes this shift in the solo career about writing about himself, often without metaphor, really.
Yeah.
And, you know, that is a well that you need some other wells that you can go into to get stuff out of. And, you know, I'm not trying to turn it into a Paul versus John thing, but I think you could argue that that was the thing that, you know, Paul, sometimes he could be writing something deeply personal, or sometimes it could not. And you might not be able to tell the difference. Whereas with John, you know, he's literally, you know, his songs are very explicitly about himself. And I think he perhaps forgets how to use the muscle of just writing an imaginary piece, like a Mr. Kite type song.
Yeah, I think one of the things is the work ceases to have that universal resonance.
Yeah.
So particularly suddenly you get Sometime in New York City, which is sort of reportage. That's a different thing. That's like a documentary style. But then the rest of his output is pretty sparse for a start. You know, it's not very prolific. But someone said, you know, a lot of these albums just consist of rather apologetic love songs addressed to Yoko.
Yeah.
And they could only be addressed to Yoko.
Yeah.
So, you know, when George writes something or Paul writes, let's say, My Love, you know, these are love songs. But if John writes, I know, you know, or I assume a saying, I'm sorry. I mean, yeah. It's clearly it's to Yoko. It's about his relationship with her. And that universal resonance starts to disappear, I think.
But you know what? And I am a big fan of Double Fantasy. I think Double Fantasy pulls some of that back. I know we're heading a bit off track at the minute, but Double Fantasy, you know, it does have a song like, you know, Just Like Starting Over, which is kind of explicitly about himself, obviously. But I think that a song like that, and also maybe Woman, you know, they are songs that you can extrapolate into your own life. They do have a universality or basically a pop sensibility to them.
Yeah, I think that's, I think those are two good examples. I think those are two good examples. Beautiful Boy as well, I suppose, is sort of anyone with children that's.
Yeah, it's a Beautiful Boy. And again, it's about him, but it could be about anyone. But look, let's rewind back to 1970.
Yes.
And not 1980. So it's September 1970, 15th, their visas expire. They come back to London. As far as we know, he doesn't connect with Janov ever again. Once he comes back to London, there is no attempt to even go back to any of this.
I'm not aware of any reconnection at all.
Yeah. And, you know, what's interesting is, you know, Janov in 1970, he's 46 years old. He only died in 2017, Arthur Janov. And he did speak a lot about the John and Yoko days. He certainly
milked it. Is that what verb you're looking for?
Yeah, it's the verb I was trying to avoid. but, you know, what else is John to do except the 26th of September, he goes in between Abbey Road and Ascot Sound Studios to start recording the Plastic Ono Band tracks. And, you know, if you're keeping an eye on what's been happening this year, you know, Paul already has McCartney out. Ringo already has a Sentimental Journey out way at the start of the year. Boku of Blues is on the way. George has started recording All Things Must Pass in May, although it's not out yet. I don't know, has he heard any of the sessions yet? But he is the last Beatle to get in the door of a studio to record a full-on solo album.
Yes.
And it starts on the 26th of September, and we're kind of looking at roughly a four-week period. You know, it's the end of October when the acetates are cut for the album. So it's efficient.
Pretty quick. Yeah, it's quick. It's pretty quick.
And so who are we talking about? Who are the key players on the album?
Well, essentially it's a trio. It's John, it's Klaus Voormann on bass, Ringo on drums, and then Phil Spector and Billy Preston each play piano on one track. So it's you know, it's not a power trio, but it's a very stripped down set of instrumentation.
And Yoko is there as well.
Wind. She's credited with Wind, which I suppose
for that.
Yeah, I suppose it was intended to be a sort of, you know, like breeze.
Yes, the environment, the atmosphere.
Yes, but unfortunately, there's a double meaning there. So,
and Spectre is a bit of a Spectre. Ho ho.
Yeah,
he's not really there.
He's not there at all. So Spectre had obviously produced Instant Karma. John asks him to co-produce this album, but he's not there. You know, this similar thing happens with George on All Things Must Pass. You know, Spectre is not present. And in fact, he doesn't turn up until well into these sessions. And at one point, they actually have to put an ad in the paper saying, Phil, we're ready! ! Because they couldn't get in touch with him.
Which is a bit embarrassing, really.
Well, you know, Phil turns up on the 9th of October for John's birthday.
Okay. Well, that's a date we'll come back to in a moment.
Yeah.
Let's rewind back because they start on the 26th of September, and the first song that they record is the first song on the album. And I guess as a mission statement, you know, Mother is everything that's been going on
in one song.
Yeah.
And I know you have that theory about it's always very important to look at with the Beatles the first song that they record for any album, and a project. And I think this is absolutely ties in with that. As you say, everything that is going on in his life, everything that is tumbling out because of primal therapy, and everything that will come on the album is sort of encapsulated in this one song.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it starts off with that kind of low tolling bell. And it's, I guess, you know, if you're back in that mindset of buying the record in 1970, you're kind of asking yourselves, well, you know, could this be Beatles? Does this sound like the Beatles? Is this the Beatles? And, you know, 50% of the Beatles are there, plus the third guy is a Beatles confidant, but it's not really the Beatles.
It's probably, you know, let's set Ringo's sentimental journey to one side, but you're so cruel, but leaving that to one side, you know, this is probably as far away from the Beatles side, this particular song, as you're going to get.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't really bear comparison with anything. You know, I've said elsewhere that, you know, All Things Must Pass, George is running away from the Beatles sound. And I think with this song, John is running in a different direction. But
he is. I think there are threads on Plastic Ono Band that just remind me of the White Album.
Yes.
If I'm looking for some kind of antecedent, you know, recording, I think that's where it is. In terms of some of the dryness of it and some of the corners that Lennon is looking around.
Well, two things I would say is some of these songs date back to 68. But also for all that Plastic Ono Band is described as this raw, rock, noisy, stripped down album, there are quite a few quiet, introspective songs, quite beautiful songs. So it's not, you know, it's not that we're not listening to the Ramones and we're not listening to the Velvet Underground here. It has that reputation, but it does have some really rather beautiful, delicate songs. Mother is not one of them.
No, but I have to admit, like when I was a teenager and trying to get into the Beatles and the solo Beatles, you know, I heard that Plastic Ono Band is this primal scream therapy album.
Yeah, yeah.
And I expected, oh, okay, I guess it's full of screaming. And aside from kind of the end screams at the end of Mother, which are very cathartic and shocking and striking, it's not, as you say, it's not like a Ramones noise album to any degree. And, you know, some of those songs do sound quite relaxed, and if you're not listening to the lyrics, you know, they're kind of easy listening in a way, you know.
Yes
But yeah, so Mother is the first thing that they record, and you know, we probably don't need to go into the ins and outs about what the song is about. It's, you know, it's basically to both his parents. He said it was about his parents, but also about 99% of parents alive or dead.
He played this live at the One to One concert in New York, his only real sort of full live show. And I mean, it's a sort of interesting choice to do live. You would think that I have to say it's not a great version because it lacks the drama of a sort of grand piano and the ambience that Spectre brings to the studio production. But you know, and how do you end a song like that live? And if you listen to the version on live in New York City, it's a kind of slightly, it sort of comes stuttering to an end.
Well, it's you know, yeah, I like you listen to that live version, you're kind of thinking, was he backstage going, oh, I'll slip in that song Mother, that'll get me in a vibe, you know? It's so deeply specific and personal. Like I can't imagine being in the crowd sort of elbowing each other going, oh great, here we go.
Yes, this is the one. Yes, if you're playing John Lennon bingo, this is not the one that you want. But I mean, he you know, again, shades of Paul recording Oh Darling. You know, he overdubs the vocal, he does more vocal takes on this, he knows what he's going for.
Yeah. And at the time of talking today, there is no Plastic Ono Band box set coming out that we were hoping for in 2020. No. There is an alternate version of Mother on the 1998 anthology
Yes,
it's got kind of a nice kind of different guitar sound to it. But maybe we'll be getting a plastic Ono Band box set some other day.
It's, I have to say, that's it's extremely disappointing, because from what we know of these sessions, you know, there are lots of alternate takes. You have the demos that you can pick up on bootlegs. They there's a lot of jamming in the studio on rock and roll oldies. You know, there's a lot of material there, and I'm surprised and disappointed.
Well, let's talk a little bit, because there is a documentary out there, one of these classic album documentaries about the Plastic Ono Band record, and it's definitely worth seeking out. It's a fantastic hour. I believe it's on Amazon Prime in certain parts of the world.
It is.
It's kind of, it's odd that the documentary exists, because normally it's Imagine that gets all the documentaries and the kudos, but I'm kind of glad it exists, if only for Ringo being interviewed and being so absolutely fantastic in it. It's a good...
Ringo is excellent on this, you know, he's yeah.
Yeah, and he kind of says at the end, you know, I don't mind talking about this record because it's great and I'm great on it and it's all good. And he knows, you know, he knows it's a special piece, and he is fantastic on this album.
It's probably his finest performance, recorded performance. And I mean, he makes a comment in that documentary where he says, you know, I've been involved in lots of albums and lots of records, some of which I can't remember, some of which I'm not proud of, but this one was really something special. And you do get a sense from watching that and from listening to him and Klaus Voormann, who's being interviewed at the same time, that for all of the subject matter, that they had an absolute ball making this.
Yeah, and, you know, we should give kudos to Klaus as well, who is a great bass player, but a very different bass player to Paul.
Yeah.
And if you take them as a rhythm section, Klaus is exactly the right man for this album. He's not being, you know, we all love a fiddly Paul bass line, but he's being very straightforward. He's locked into the songs, he's in the groove when it needs be, and as a rhythm section, it's different to a true Beatles rhythm section.
Yes, I mean, he's not, you know, he's not showing off, is what you're trying to say.
like
it's a bad thing. You know, it's a very sparse style.
Yeah.
Ringo's drumming, similarly, it's not showy, but if you start to pay attention to it, if you start to try and focus on the drums, it's sensational.
Yeah.
And it probably is, I would say, the sort of the pinnacle of Ringo's career as a drummer. You know, you've talked about how much you regret the fact that Ringo sort of stopped being a drummer and became a vocalist and
yeah,
you know, the drumming on Abbey Road, the drumming on Plastic Ono Band is amazing.
Yeah.
And then he suddenly sort of reverts back to, you know, I'm a singer, so that becomes his main thing.
Yeah, his kind of all-round entertainer thing. And it's his life, he's free to do that, you know, of course. But yeah, his drumming is sensational, even when he's, you know, even up to modern day when he's appearing on, you know, like the Jenny Lewis record and all that recently.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
So what we might do is, you know, we've started talking about the recording session of Mother, which is the start of the sessions, but we might actually walk through the songs in the order that they appear on the album. and maybe come back and talk about a couple of key dates as we go along during those sessions. So the second track on the album is Hold On. And it's sort of a, you know, if you're listening to the album, it's a bit of a gear shift after the very intense opening of Mother that you get Hold On as your second track.
Well, if you think about the placement of that song, this is a song that was done right at the end of the recording session. There was a very rough mix done that John took away to sort of listen to and then come back and do more work. And he decided he liked the rough mix and that was good enough. And he just went with that. So originally it was intended to have some more work done. And as you say, the placement is obviously after that cathartic ending to Mother, then this is a sort of comforting song. This is a hold on, you know, everything is going to be all right. This is sort of the way forward where he's saying, okay, I've got rid of that. It's the two of us now.
Yeah. And so, yeah, they end up with take 32, which is the final take. And that's the one that gets used on the record. And he has this sort of ad-libbed cookie moment.
Yes.
Which is, I kind of feel that the album, you know, it's very, not claustrophobic, but it's certainly its own world, its own environment. And there's two kind of little windows in the album. And one of them is that moment where he says, cookie, which is just so... Did he say cookie?
It's a complete non sequitur in the context of the song. It means it appears to mean nothing.
Yeah,
but you're going to tell us where it came from.
Well, it says it comes from Sesame Street, and I know that's the legend that the Cookie Monster was on Sesame Street. I sometimes wonder though, because Sesame Street only started in 1969.
Yep,
and you know the Cookie Monster. Because I went off to read about the Cookie Monster. You know, he was on Sesame Street from the start, but he hadn't become, you know, he hadn't been doing his C is for Cookie stuff or any of that kind of stuff. So considering I guess he could have caught Sesame Street while he was in the States in the summer of 1970.
Well, this is what they say, that, you know, he must have seen Sesame Street. This is a link to sort of, you know, his regression to childhood. He's watching kids' TV. This is that, you know, it's, I don't know. I like to think he was sitting watching Sesame Street. I think that's a very good explanation. There is another song that uses the same.
Yes. And I hadn't noticed this. Go on.
Yeah. So the B side to Ringo's song, It Don't Come Easy, that is that early 1970. And when he's singing the verse about John and Yoko, he uses the same cookie reference in the same tone of voice. So it's clearly a nod to that song, if nothing else.
Yeah. So go listen to Ringo's cookie cover version.
But there are lots of different versions of this. As you said, there are 32 takes. So we've got, you know, fast versions, slow versions, different drum patterns, different lyric changes. There's a kind of bluesy version on that anthology box set. So there's a lot of material here. You know, there's a comparatively simple sounding song, 32 takes, tried out in different versions, different variations. We want to hear that.
Yeah, and it's kind of instructive because I think, you know, Plastic Ono Band, the album sort of has this notion of, you know, oh, it's very uncluttered and it's very plain. And I think that's often thought of over the years as being, well, it wasn't really thought out. He just went in and got the songs down. But that's not true. These things are definitely thought out, planned, rehearsed, changed. I mean, you know, they're efficient and John and Ringo know how to make an efficient record.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's definitely not, you know, oh, I just have to get this out of my system. He's definitely playing with the form.
Yes, it's not a casual approach to this. What you can say is that they are not embellished in any way. So you might, if this was a Beatles recording, you make that basic recording and then you think, do I add an orchestra? Do I get Paul in to play a recorder on this? Do I, you know, get George to do a slide part? You start to embellish. These are the basic takes that in a Beatles album, George Martin would be doing a bit of arranging or doing overdubbing, and you would be building up. These are the basic tracks that would provide the building block.
Yes.
For a Beatles record.
Yeah. So next track then is I Found Out. And that's, I like I Found Out. I think, you know, we talk about Ringo there. That's got a good kind of motoric kind of...
It's got a groove.
Kind of drum, yeah. It's
just got a good groove. Yeah, yeah, yeah. This is one of my favorite songs, I have to say. So the thing about this is where he says, he talks about Carl Wolf.
Right.
You know, which seems to be an explanation to say, I want this to be a mix of Howling Wolf and Carl Perkins. And he's ad-libbing on some Carl Perkins song. So this is a great song. And John doesn't often get credit or doesn't get enough credit for his guitar work.
Yeah.
And there's some absolutely great basic driving guitar work on this.
And there's the original session for I Found Out, or one of the sessions for I Found Out, leads us to all these oldies that were recorded, which is odd. That's
yes.
We should probably talk about John's 9th and 10th of October, which were weird to say the least.
Yes, so this is slap bang in the middle of the recording session, and of course, the 9th of October is his birthday.
Yeah, and it's interesting, you know, you kind of think it's his 30th birthday, so that's a significant date.
He's an old man.
What had we all done by our 30th birthdays? I wonder. You know, well, John is, yeah, you know, letting it all go, and you know, 1960, he's in the Kaiser Keller. 1980, he's, you know, he's given interviews in the Dakota. But in 1970, he's recording the album. But his 30th birthday is not a happy occasion.
No, his birthday starts, you know, you imagine he kind of wakes up, has breakfast in bed. Yoko brings him, you know, a boiled egg with a little birthday candle in it, something like that. But yes. Then he's invited his dad to come and visit him at Tittenhurst.
Yeah. So this is the last time he ever sees his dad.
Yes. Yes. Oh, yes.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes. So this is Alf, or Freddie Lennon, turns up with his lovely young wife, Pauline, and their son, David Henry Lennon. And this is the first time that John is meeting his half-brother.
Yeah. And John is a bit
that sums it up, I think. Yeah. I think you can say this is not a success. This is not a happy reunion.
Well, it seems to be that this is a, and maybe understandably, as we said, he never finished the Primal Therapy, that whatever happens sets John off on an absolute tirade to the point that Alf Lennon fears for his life, essentially. John just kind of lets rip.
Yes, yes, absolutely. So according to, you know, now bear in mind, this is Alf Lennon's, Freddie Lennon's take on this, but he's saying, you know, at one point, John is saying, you know, I will have you killed. Mm. And his father seems genuinely, as you say, to be in fear for his life. So he's saying that, you know, John launches into an account of his visit to America, his voice, you know, rises into a scream. He starts talking about his relationship with his mother. Mm. He said he reviled his mother in unspeakable terms, referring also to his aunt that had brought him up in similar derogatory terms, as well as one or two of his closest friends. So I wonder who those friends would be. So he said, he would kill me. I would be carried out to sea and dumped, in 20, 50, or perhaps you would prefer 100 fathoms deep. So he was so petrified by this that he writes a letter and leaves it with his solicitor. So it's like one of those, if something happens to me, give this letter to the authorities. You know, he seems genuinely, but you've got to kind of wonder, what was John thinking? What was his intention in inviting him? Did he invite him with the idea, you know, yeah, this could be a great family sort of reunion or reconciliation? He's meeting his half-brother for the first time. And then under the influence of Primal Therapy, when he sees his father, it all just kind of bubbles up. Or it's hard to think he kind of set it up.
It is. I mean, it's like, you know, it's very sad, really. And, you know, it's you know, Alf's statement is kind of hard to read, you know, where he says, yeah, John's whole tirade was uttered with malignant glee, as though he was actually participating in the terrible deed. Yeah, it's all a bit miserable. But then when Alf is kind of shouted, yes, and berated off the Tittenhurst estate, John and Yoko go back into the studio and hang out with all their pals.
Yes, yes. So by mid-afternoon after lunch, they're back in the studio. Ringo's there. George is there. Mal Evans is there. Some cake is there.
Important.
And they're having a birthday. And Donovan couldn't make it, yes, unfortunately. But he sends a taped message.
He's the first person to ever send a taped message to a birthday party.
Yeah. Yeah.
So does Nina Simone. Apparently, message.
Yep. And weirdly.
Yeah, this is weird.
Janis Joplin.
Yeah.
So on the 9th of October, Janis Joplin sends a taped birthday message to John Lennon.
And but the problem with that is?
She had died on the 4th of October. So yeah, between recording the message and it reaching John, she had passed away.
That is very bleak. And George arrives in a Ferrari, which is nice.
Well, how else would George arrive?
Nice motor.
nice motor. So yes, George arrives, and there's an engineer, Andy Stevens, who was working there, and he said George had a Ferrari 330 GTC, dark blue with a cream interior, for those like Paul who are keen on these things. And he said they had this sort of beautiful car with a little tacky plastic flower in a holder on the windscreen, which he then gives to John as a birthday present. But this is if you've got All Things Must Pass, George has recorded
it's Johnny's birthday,
yeah, and he plays that, you know.
And Yoko got him a sensory box.
Yeah, that's very kind of late 60s. That seems a little dated by 1970.
So it's described by Andy Stevens as twice the size of a shoebox with lots of holes in it. You had to put your finger in it, and one hole would be warm and mushy, one would be wet, one would have a pin in it. John had a ball with this present.
I don't want that for my birthday, please. Don't get me that.
Interesting is obviously Paul is missing, and maybe it's not that interesting, or it's not that, it's pretty obvious that Paul is missing, but it is, you know, it does give you this notion of, you know, how silence becomes a vacuum in a deteriorating friendship. Mm. How, you know, who would have known if there was mobile phones in 1970, if a little birthday text wouldn't have broken the ice, you know?
A little WhatsApp group.
Well, it was like that brief moment in time when David Crosby and Roger McGuinn were tweeting each other until
it all went wrong.
Blocked them. Which is very, very sad.
We were all hoping for a Birds reunion.
Yeah, didn't happen. And Phil Spector also arrives. So they get...
Phil has seen the ad in the paper and arrives.
Never want to turn down a bit of cake. He rocks up. And then, the following day is then, what I was saying is that day of I Found Out, where they're doing on the 10th of October all these kind of rock and roll oldies, John's kind of stalwart tunes. And we've never heard any of these.
No, I've certainly never heard these bootlegs. I'm sure someone out there can enlighten us and send us copies of these.
We couldn't be doing that.
But
breaking the law in a limited way.
In a limited and specific way. So they do That's All Right Mama, Glad All Over, Honey Don't Be Cruel, Hound Dog, Matchbox. So this is John, Ringo and Klaus just jamming on some oldies. We want to hear this.
We want to hear this. Yeah, absolutely.
If Yoko's listening, you know.
She is.
Get the box set out.
So going back to the album running order, next up we have Working Class Hero, which I don't know. I'm not a total Working Class Hero.
You're not a fan?
Fan, you know. No, do you not think it's a bit... It hasn't aged well, maybe?
Yeah, I think it hasn't aged well. The interesting thing about the recording is it's two takes spliced together.
Yeah.
A bit like Strawberry Fields. I'm not going to tell you where the join is. There's a prize if people can can spot the join. No, it's sort of become a cliche. You know, I don't know if working class hero was a phrase that was a cliche in 1970, but or whether this song made it a cliche.
That's a good point. I don't know, actually.
You know, and there's a lot of criticism about, you know, he wasn't working class. He was the most middle class of the band, and he's sort of rewriting history. And in 1980, he makes a comment where he said, "Oh, nobody ever got that song right. It was sardonic. It wasn't anything to do with socialism. It was to do with, if you want to go through that trip, you'll get to where I am. This is what you'll end up. I've been successful as an artist, and that made me happy and unhappy. I've been unknown. I was happy and unhappy. But what Yoko's taught me is the real success is my relationship with her and the child.
Yeah.
My relationship with the world. It's nothing to do with rock or the rock machinery." So my reading of that is perhaps he was slightly distancing himself, where he was trying to put a different spin.
He certainly is trying to put a spin on it to sort of say, I think almost what he was trying to say was, if you're being kind, you can say, look, he's not saying he's working class, but he's saying that people are stamping him as a working class hero, irrespective of that. I mean, what's interesting when you look at that Rolling Stone interview from 1980 is, you know, just how much he had in common with Paul at the end of the day, you know?
And, yeah.
You know, it's really fascinating that John and Paul got married at the same time, that they're finding their feet in their marriages at the same time, and they're both sort of creating a form of art that says, I just want to be me with my wife at the minute, and I'm just going to do it my way. And, you know, they were doing the same thing, essentially.
The thing that had never, I mean, literally this has just occurred to me as you're saying that, is that the women that they married each had a daughter.
Yes.
So they each were sort of becoming stepdad to their partner's child, and you've got to think if that relationship with Yoko's daughter had been different, and that the daughter had been, Kyoko had been present and had been part of their lives, and if, you know, we talked about Yoko sort of suffering these series of miscarriages, and yeah. You think, well, if John had the sort of more stable family unit that Paul had in 69, 70, 71, would they have got to that 1980 point more quickly? Would they have sort of suddenly recognized these points of similarity, these things in common?
Yeah, it's hard to know. Next up on the album is Isolation, which is kind of a song for our times.
I love this song.
Yeah.
I think this is just a fantastic song.
I think you're right. You know, I think it gets the balance right between that kind of thing we were talking about earlier on in terms of what's specific and what's universal. And it does have a universality to it, you know?
Yes, I mean, I think that's exactly it. You know, he's singing, initially he's singing very much, you know, about his own personal experience, and then he kind of opens that up. And this is one of my top five solo Lennon songs, I think.
And Paul DeNoyer kind of says the same thing. It transcends the well-worn lonely at the top trap by generalizing the emotions that many people feel at times. And it's a song that's been covered. And I think it's a good song to cover because it's, you know, maybe a lesser known Lennon song than some of the bigger hits.
Yeah. So Harry Nilsson.
Yeah.
Recorded it, but my favorite cover version is by Marianne Faithfull. You can pick that up on A Perfect Stranger, the Island Anthology. I don't know if this had come out before or whether it was recorded for that record, but Marianne Faithfull's cover is superb.
Yeah. And so that gets us to the end of side one, if you're playing the album on vinyl. Side two then opens with Remember. Now, I love Remember.
And what comes after Remember?
You don't like Remember.
I don't. I think this is probably the sort of slightest song on the album. It's the one I like least.
Yeah.
But tell me why you like it so much.
Well, first of all, I said earlier on that, you know, when John says cookie, it's a little window in the album. It's a little moment of, you know, of amusement.
Levity.
Yeah, and I think Remember is right in the middle of the album. It's got this kind of rockin' vibe. It does sound, although he didn't know this at the time, it sounds like one of my favorite bands, Spoon, with this kind of rollicking piano part to it. But the second window on the album that's kind of silly and stupid is the explosion noise at the end of the song, you know, which is just a joke.
Yeah. And, remember the...
The 5th of November.
Remember, bang. Yeah, but this is because it wasn't, it's a song that doesn't go anywhere.
Yeah. But it's got so good Ringo. It's like, thank God for Ringo. Because Ringo is just giving it sticks. And
Ringo,
just keeping that rocking. Like, if Ringo wasn't there, you'd be bored.
Ringo saves the song. Yes, Ringo. The only reason I can listen to the song is the drumming. And this I think, is the song that started out as that coda.
Yeah.
To Something.
Yes. And if you listen to Something, it has, it does have that same kind of progression, that kind of coda of Something.
Yeah. So for a long time in all of the versions of Something, as they're working through that, there's this Lennon banging away on the chords. But the interesting thing about that is Paul's bass line. Mm-hmm. On the coda version, which is, we talked about it being a sort of fussy, or Paul slightly showy. Paul, I think, recognizes this is a dull chord progression, and he's really doing his very best to kind of liven up what's happening.
Yeah. So we're 50-50 split on Remember. So that leads us to the next track, which is Love. And that's a very straightforward kind of song. It was almost potentially a single. It certainly got a lot of airplay and attention at the time. Isn't that right?
Yes, it did. I mean, this is the track on which Phil Spector is playing piano.
Right.
This is a song that, I mean, it's got that very long fade in.
Yeah.
It kind of irritates me a little bit.
Okay.
Sorry. Well, what I mean is it's...
It's twee, is it?
It's a little bit... I think it's a little bit... twee. And it's the one song that I think maybe doesn't sit comfortably in the context of the album. I think it's a bit of a throwback. I know he's maybe talking about, you know, his love for Yoko, and it's, you know, just Yoko and me, and that ties in with Hold On and all the rest of it. But I think the sentiment is a little bit twee.
Yeah, I can understand that. I mean, it did eventually appear on the first posthumous collection, the John Lennon collection, in 1982, and it got some attention there. I think, you know, it's one of these, again, the album kind of has light and shade on it, and, you know, the fact that it's there makes you a little less worried for John, maybe, than some of the other songs.
I think so. I mean, they remixed it, didn't they? They sort of took that long fade out for the 82 compilation, and there was a kind of tie-in promotional single. So, I mean, that's all I have to say.
Is it the one you skip? Because I think the next track, Well, 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 might be the track that I tend to skip. I'm not really sure.
No, I like this song.
Do you? Okay.
Yeah.
This is
just another one of those kind of driving rock tracks. I think he did this live in New York as well. Why don't you like this song? This is a great rock and roll.
It's
listening to this kind of stuff that makes me want to hear the outtakes, that wants to hear them kind of jamming in the studio. And
that is true. You know, you kind of get a, you know, it does have that sense of the band in action, you know. You know, the fact that so much of this was cut live and that there's so much on the floor does make you worry. I don't know, I guess maybe it's just to do with some of the other surrounding tracks that makes me not my number one moment on the
album. This makes me fear for my episode suggestion of the importance of the word "well" in John Lennon's career.
Go on then.
I'll just leave that there for people to think how frequently he sings that word as a kind of, you know, I'm thinking, think of rock and roll album.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, I mean, that word, he just, Yeah, I think I'm going to work up the notes for that episode.
Now, a few years ago, I noticed that Elvis Costello regularly sings about clowns and windows and birds. And once you notice that, they pop up in his lyrics all the time. Clowns, yeah. Windows and birds. That's another side project that there's a podcast in that. You know?
Well, it's like George Harrison is the only person I've ever heard sing the phrase nervous system. and he does that several times on several different songs.
He's obsessed with his nervous system.
His nervous system.
Track 9 then is Look At Me. And this is a kind of I think Love, you could say, is a bit of a Beatles song. But Look At Me is a song that was in the Beatles ether, wasn't it?
Definitely. This was written around the White Album time. So this is the song where we can say that it's the Donovan.
Donovan. Donovan is present on Plastic Ono Band.
Donovan is present. He apparently taught the Beatles that finger-picking guitar pattern.
Fantastic.
Now, again, doesn't like to talk about
it. But it's cut from the same cloth as Dear Prudence and Julia and all those songs as well.
Yeah. You can hear that, yeah.
And there is an outtake on it, which, again, this 98 anthology, which is an odd box set, the John Lennon anthology box set.
Yeah, I think that was a missed opportunity. You know, yeah. It's sort of not one thing and it's not the other thing. It doesn't really flow. It gives you little insights into things that you think, yes, that's very nice, but I'd like to hear what happened after that. I'd like to hear the next track or the next version. Or
I mean, you can track the history of box sets by looking at John Lennon box sets. You know, you have that kind of 1990 yeah. box set, which is like a glorified greatest hits. You have the 98 anthology box set, which is, you know, alternate cuts. And then eventually we get into, you know, album box sets with the Imagine box set. So hopefully we'll get more album based box sets. But there's a Look At Me. I remember it's used in the Royal Tenenbaums, that movie. That anthology version is on that soundtrack and it's used in that movie, and it's really striking.
This is this where he has double track vocals and he speaks to himself at the beginning of the song.
Yes, he does.
He says, "You okay? Yes, thank you." You know, that again, this you were saying, there's little moments of levity here. So,
but speaking of moments of levity, let's go to the big closer, sort of, which is the track God. And he's in the same way that Mother opens the album and, you know, maybe throws you for a loop, putting God at the end is making another very specific statement. They are two very specific bookends.
Yes. And again, I in the context of what we said earlier about, you know, you do the first part of Primal Therapy and then you need to kind of build yourself back up again. You could see this as part of him tearing down the sort of, you know, graven images, the kind of these great cultural kind of touchstones and that he's rejecting. And then he's just saying, well, it's just me and Yoko, just the two of us. That's what replaces all of that. And I think that's the sort of the inadequacy of the exercise that he went through. But this must have been a sort of profoundly shocking thing in 1970 for a Beatles fan.
Yeah, I think, you know, you take a song like God, and perhaps after 50 years, we haven't realized how striking it is. It actually says something that hasn't really been said before, that we haven't heard before. And I'm not just talking about the I don't believe in Beatles bit. I basically mean that, you know, in 1970, when songwriting's getting very kind of personal and confessional, you know, for him to kind of sing, you know, God is a concept by which we measure our pain, you're like, wait, what? You know?
Yes.
And we also, you know, we also talk about, hey, isn't it amazing how they got from, you know, I Feel Fine to Strawberry Fields in 2 or 3 years. But it's also kind of amazing that they get from, you know, Revolution or Hey Jude to something as, it's quite a trip, God, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, you're right. And I mean, Janov remarks on this and sort of saying, you know, he can take this idea that he just came out with this notion, you know, what do you believe in God? And people who have been through these terrible things tend to believe in God, to cling to, and then it goes, oh, you mean God is a concept by which we measure our pain? And Janov said, bang, there you go.
It's striking that it's actually his thought. It's not a thought that he has lifted or taken from somewhere else. It's his own conclusion.
Exactly. I must admit, I always assumed that this was something he had heard or read or just had come across in some fashion, and then he had repurposed it for this. But this, according to Janov's recounting of the conversation, this seems to be an original sort of response. And it's a very striking, as you say, it is a very striking phrase.
Yeah. And so he starts writing the song when he's in Janov therapy in Bel Air in the middle of the summer, and he's kind of skirting around where it leads to, you know. And it's a song of two halves, you know. There's the kind of the introductory God part, and then there's his declarations for the second half.
So there are early versions of this where he's recording demos that came out in 2004 on the acoustic album, where there's a sort of guitar version. But really nothing approaches the sort of, I don't know, is it grandeur or the sort of impact of what it's Billy Preston now playing the piano. And there is this kind of sort of gospel-y feel, which there's a sort of irony there, but that's obviously what he was going for with Billy Preston delivering this piano.
Well, again, it leads to this notion that this album, although it was fast and efficient, it wasn't slapdash. And the notion of bringing Billy Preston in to play, you know, after an album where John has played most of the piano in his rudimentary, straightforward style, that to know that actually, no, what this song needs is Billy Preston delivering a very spiritual type of piano line. Goes to show that this is considered and thought out, and you know, it is a produced record.
As you say, it's a perfect sort of bookending. It's a sort of the sort of final section. There's a sort of resolution there.
Yes,
you know, but this the other aspect of this is, you know, the dream is over. So you were saying there are sort of sections to this song and statements. So the big kind of statements that really set you back on your heels as a Beatles fan in 1970 are, I don't believe in Beatles, but then the dream is over.
Yes, and that's probably a heavier statement than not believing in Beatles, because you know, you can almost say, oh, of course John Lennon is saying that, look at him go. But he's actually building on that to say, you know, we're done. There's other stuff to do.
That's it. And I mean, this to my way of thinking ties in with where we started this podcast, where we were talking about the sort of the year one for peace. So they're starting in January 1970. They're still very much on this peace kick. There's a sort of idealism there. But by the end of the year, when this comes out, he's saying very explicitly, it's over. The dream is over. And he makes the point in the Rolling Stone interview, I'm not just talking about the Beatles is over. I'm talking about the generation thing. The dream is over. And I personally, I've got to get down to so-called reality. So it's this, he has become literally the man of the decade. You know, he's kind of awarded this accolade at the end of the 60s. And he's stepping back. He's saying, Look, it's over. It's almost a kind of we tried and we failed.
Interesting. Like at that time, you know, there was still this notion that rock music was going to find the path forward. And I'm thinking of the very self-righteous Pete Townsend type stuff that he's going, where he really thought he was going to levitate the audience into the future, and we were all going to find the meaning of life. But Lennon is probably the first person to pull the plug on all of that.
I think so. I mean, certainly the most high profile. You know, in America, you've got, you know, Crosby, Stills and Nash in 69. That debut album has come out. That's kind of absolutely just tapping into the kind of the politics, the personal, you know, 69 tipping into 1970. The whole mood is changing. And yes, John Lennon is the first one really to say, look, didn't work.
Yeah.
You know, and what follows that, interestingly, from Lennon's personal point of view, is this suddenly he's into sloganeering and he's into very sort of in your face political statements. So it's the sort of all you need is love dreamism, or is the way I interpret that. Mm. And then suddenly it's into direct action and marching in the streets and
being himself. The other amazing thing about the song God is, of course, once again, we're back on Ringo and Ringo's drum fills.
Yes.
After each I don't believe in, which he recounts again in the documentary we mentioned earlier on, how he does a different drum fill each time. And each time. If you go into the alternate versions that we know are out there, the drum fills are different each time.
Yeah.
And it's so extraordinary. He says whenever he's doing a drum fill, whether it's like a day in the life or whatever it is, he has to feel it in the moment. That's what he says.
Yes. Again, we're just back to this point that the drumming on this album is sensational. Yeah. And it's this notion that Ringo brings from the Beatles about everything is in the service of the song.
Well, Ringo says it in that documentary. He says, the track is what we're playing for. That's what he says at one point. I think he's talking about I Found Out. And he says, you know, he's there to serve the track. That is the Ringo mantra.
Yeah.
And on God, it's very, very apparent.
Yes. I mean, he's doing something technically very interesting, but he's not showboating in any way.
Yeah.
And I suppose if you think about it, you do just have this repetitive, slightly gospel style. But it's never boring. And the drumming is part of that. But you don't instinctively think what's making this interesting is the drumming. Mm. But if you take the drumming out, it is a very sort of
dirgy,
repetitive sort of list.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, so go back and listen to God. It's really unlike anything else. The first time I heard God was as a teenager. I went off to see the Imagine John Lennon documentary in 1988. And it uses the song God very powerfully in that. I'd never heard the song before. And they're doing a montage and it basically comes to, I don't believe in Beatles. And I was like, what did he say?
Yes.
Oh my God. And I was shocked.
I had the same thing. The first time I ever heard this album was on cassette.
Yeah.
And it was the younger brother of a friend of mine. He was a Beatles fan. And he said to me, listen to this song, listen to what he says, you know, and I have a feeling in my head that the cassette has a slightly different running order. But that was a shock. And this was sort of in 79, maybe.
Yeah.
I was listening to this and, you know, I had no way of knowing what this album was or, you know, the internet didn't exist. Fire was a new thing. It was a complete shock. It was a complete shock because I was still in 79 clinging to this notion. They're going to get back together again.
And, there is a lovely notion where I think on the 74 episode, we talked about how John did a bunch of radio shows where he did a bunch of DJing towards the end of 74.
Yeah.
And he was like, he's introducing records and he's spinning them. And on one of the radio shows, he plays a Beatles record and he comes out of it and he goes, there they are. And I still believe in them. And it's really sweet. You're like, oh, it's like a little message to the rest of us, you know?
He's back.
I mean, the album would be a great album if it ended on God. It ends with the 50-second fragment of My Mummy's Dead, which is a kind of a mono recording from before the sessions, basically. It's the only part of the album that's recorded in America.
This is him just recording vocals, electric guitar. It's mono recording. It was done just as a demo. And
does it need to be there? Like, it'd be better as a hidden track, or would it be better as a? I don't know.
I think of it as a sort of Her Majesty
little
fragment. I suppose there is a resolution to God.
Mm.
The way it ends, and then suddenly this jarring. I mean, it's a you know, three blind mice melody, and it's this suddenly very jarring. Brings you right back to the start, and maybe the idea is, you know, you just then start listening to the album again. I don't know. I mean, my own sense would be yes, sort of conceptually, it might have been better to not have that there, or to put it at the end of the first side, and actually have God as the sort of a day in the life or the end, the big closer, and there's a sense of resolution to it.
Yeah.
But it leaves you with the sense that all this has been for nothing, all this therapy, all this, you know.
Well, maybe that is the point, that it, that you know, even after 40 minutes of him explaining all of this stuff, it just comes back to that feeling that he gets from therapy, that that is the thing that that he cannot fix.
That's quite depressing.
Sorry to be depressing. But it is a great record. So they record the album, as we say, between the 26th of September, and then they have a working acetate cut of the album on the 30th of October. And the album eventually comes out in December, on the 11th of December. In the meantime, John and Yoko go off to New York. They go to Abco, where they meet May Pang for the first time.
Yes.
So there's another chapter opening.
It's a foreshadowing, yeah.
Yeah. And in between, you know, the album being finished and the album coming out, as you mentioned earlier on, John does this big famous Rolling Stone interview that comes out at the start of 71. So, you know, he's really finishing off 1970 as, you know, clearing the decks of everything he wants to say.
Yeah, I mean, he's still, again, and this is my point for all of that therapy, you know, he gets all of this out on the album, and then he gives the Rolling Stone interview. He's still clearly an incredibly angry man, a kind of troubled individual at that stage. He's you know, you don't get a sense that this has brought him closure.
Yeah. And the album goes top 10 in the UK and in the States, number 8 in the UK, number 6 in the States, and it's kind of lasted the distance, you know. I still feel it has I think some people kind of think maybe Imagine is his debut album, you know, that in the general popular consciousness, that, you know, it's still feels a little bit of a secret record in a way.
I think that's right. I mean, there isn't a hit single. It's not got a sort of commercial heft to it. It's not a pop. It doesn't sit in the sort of timeline. So if you could sort of sonically could move from Abbey Road to Imagine.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly.
You know, it doesn't sit with McCartney. It doesn't sit with All Things Must Pass. It's a separate thing. Plus, there's the language, Jason. There's the language.
Well, yes, and I didn't really want to mention it, but there is language, and on the sleeve.
On several tracks, Jason. There's language on several tracks.
Well, he uses all the vernacular, but that was a big deal at the time. That had to be stated on the sleeve that EMI wouldn't let him print the F word on the sleeve.
Yeah. EMI insisted that the lyrics, which are on the inner sleeve, were censored, and he made a point of saying, at the request of EMI.
Yes.
But you know about the Australian version of this album?
Oh, there's another change, isn't there? What's that?
On the Australian version, because they're sensitive types in Australia, not keen on language, no. There is a version of Working Class Hero in which that doesn't appear at all.
It's just edited out. Yes.
They kind of just revamp. They take the whole line and rejig the whole thing. Masterpiece of editing.
There have been reissues and things over the year, but generally the bonus tracks they stick on the CD aren't very good. I'm not a fan of the Oz tracks or any of that kind of stuff, to be honest.
No, I mean, I think this is one of the, you know, it's like Sgt. Pepper. This is an album that sort of, you know, it's a conceptual piece. It doesn't need anything stuck on. They're not very good tracks. And they, if Yoko's listening, they completely ruined the remaster edition. You know.
Oh, did? Oh, right. Yes, yes, yes. Well, so, listen, all the more reason, if she's listening, to sort out that box set.
Yes.
And
perhaps she'd like to come on to the podcast.
She would.
Have a chat.
We would love that. So what do you all think, folks? John Lennon, Plastic Ono Band, the first album from John Lennon, 50th anniversary in 2020. It stands the test of time. It's an extraordinary first statement. And, you know, we've covered a lot of ground today, but it is interesting how things like therapy and yoga and vegetarianism, all these kind of things that are part and parcel of life these days, were all, you know, ciphered in by the Fabs themselves back in the day. That, as unusual as they might have seemed at the time, you know, we don't kind of think a second thought about these things these days, really.
No. We're going to leave you now and go off and get some therapy.
Okay. Well, yes. Well, don't forget, John doesn't believe in yoga. He really sticks it to yoga.
Oh, right.
But what do you think, folks? Once again, we hope we've sent you back to the shelves to pull down and blow the dust off your copy of John Lennon Plastic Ono Band. But let us know in the usual places. We remain on Twitter at Beatles Pod, where you have the private Facebook group, which Stephen runs, so you can ask to join the Facebook group there. And wherever you download your podcasts, if you want to leave a nice word, we're always appreciative for everything that everyone has said so far. But for now, my name's Jason Carty.
My name's Stephen Cockcroft.
And this has been Nothing Is Real. Thanks for listening. Nothing Is Real is powered by Acast.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Thanks for listening to Nothing Is Real. We hope you enjoyed today's episode, and if you did, why not become a member? You'll get access to ad-free content, bonus episodes, and so much more. Follow the link in the show notes, sign up on Acast Plus, or visit our website, nothingisrealpod.com.